This is Kirk Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule. Or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138. So who's with me tonight?
I'm Heather Boggs.
My name is Lydia Spidiakoff.
I am Jim Cronin.
I am Sue Perry.
This is Jerry McKee, and I'll be reading Alicia, a Montana ghost story from Kalispell, retold by S.E. Schlosser. It was the sound of laughter and children's voices that caught my attention. Curious, I materialized in my old bedroom and went out into the hallway to peer over the railing by the grand staircase. The voices had come from the great hall, where the house tours gathered. Yes, there were two children scampering about to the distraction of their parents. An older boy and a tousled-haired little toddler who reminded me of my own daughter at that age. "No, no, Alicia, don't touch," her mother agonized as the little girl flung herself onto a rocker by the fireplace. Alicia. No wonder I had felt compelled to return. There was an Alicia in this house again. How appropriate. There had been an Alicia in every generation of our family from the 1600s to the present. We'd called my little Alicia Timmy. I reminisced. The tour began, and I followed them eagerly, floating down the stairs and hovering in the grandmother's hallway. Little Alicia was swung up into her father's arms as the group moved into the library next door. Looking over his shoulder, the tousle-haired youngster saw me. She lifted her hand to me. "Hi," she piped. "Hi back," I returned solemnly. Her father glanced vaguely around, but did not see who his child was addressing. I grinned conspiratorially at the little toddler and winked. She tried to wink back, blinking her blue eyes several times in rapid succession, her face crinkling with the effort. I chuckled softly and followed the group into the dining room. I swished past Alicia's mother and went through the butler's pantry into the kitchen. Behind me, Alicia's mother shivered and asked, "Is there a draft in here?" I looked at the picture of my little Timmy on the back of the stove. Yes, this little Alicia resembled her. I perched myself on a table in the corner of the room and listened as the tour guide discussed father's obsession with southern biscuits and showed everyone the huge bin of coffee. Alicia waved a hand at me from her father's shoulder. "Lady," she said very clearly to her mother, pointing at me. Her mother looked straight at me, seeing nothing but the table. Alicia's brother turned my way and squinted very hard, as if he might be able to make out my outline if he stared hard enough. I smiled back at him. I floated up and up through the ceiling then, and settled myself in the little toy room on the upper landing, waiting for Alicia to come upstairs. I heard her little voice insisting that her father put her down. Then the sound of little feet chugging mightily as she climbed the stairs. With a smile, the woman looking into the toy room moved aside so Alicia and her brother could take a look. I couldn't resist. "Peek-a-boo," I called, appearing suddenly around the doorway. Alicia laughed in delight. "Peek-boo," she giggled, hiding her eyes behind her hands. Obediently, her big brother did the same. He obviously loved this tiny Muppet. "Come on, Peek-a-boo," Alicia's father said indulgently, picking her up again and taking her with him up to the second-floor hallway. I went to stand by the grand staircase again, watching the tourists move in and out of the guest rooms. Alicia waved to me as they entered my room, then around to my parents' bedroom, and out past the bath to the game room. Father had loved playing billiards with his guests, I mused with a smile, touching one of the balls with the tip of my finger. Beside me, the tour guide was telling the visitors about our buffalo herd. Father had been very worried about the bison. So many of them were being killed. So he bought a herd, and they roamed the roads and byways around Kalispell freely all their lives. After the head male died of old age, Father had his head stuffed by my uncle, and his head still hung in the game room. I floated up to the third floor and sat in one of the wicker chairs as the guide took the guests around to the sewing room, Father's private hideaway, the laundry room, our game room. Alicia ran all around, laughing and stomping her little feet in her cunning sneakers. She flung herself into my lap, and we stared happily at one another, giggling together, until her mother came running. "No, no, Alicia, mustn't touch!" The tour was nearly over. The group gathered in the back hallway, the grandmother's hallway, for one last bit of history. The guide showed them the secret hiding places in the wall and showed them a note I'd written to my grandmother many years ago. Then they were saying goodbye, and Alicia waved her little hand to me as her parents exited through the door of the gift shop. "Goodbye, Alicia," I called as her brother walked right through me. That felt strange to me, but worse for him, I think. He turned pale and shivered, then made a bolt for the door. "Bye-bye," Alicia called back to me as her brother pushed his father aside and fled out the screen door and down the steps to the drive. "That place is creepy," he told his mother as they walked together into the garden. "I think it's haunted." Haunted, I thought, amused. By happy memories, certainly. And perhaps occasionally by something else. I leaned out the window and waved once more to little Alicia, though the toddler didn't see me. Then I vanished.
Amber, a Texas ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Oh, you hear the stories about how dangerous Ouija boards are, but hey, it's just a game. Mary waited until midnight to begin our little game, and the four of us, Sarah, Jesse, me, and Mary, started asking all kinds of silly questions. It was a strange-looking board, covered with letters and symbols. There was a plastic pointer that was supposed to move across the board at the behest of the spirits. The instructions called it a planchet. Around 1:30 in the morning, the planchet suddenly froze in Mary's hand. It wouldn't move, no matter how much we pushed and pulled. Mary turned her frightened blue eyes toward me. "I'm not doing it," she said, lifting her hands. I grabbed the planchet myself and tried to push it around, but it was fixed to the board. Suddenly a kind of electric shock buzzed through my fingers. I gasped and tried to pull my fingers from the planchet, but they were stuck. Mary and Jesse both tried to pull my fingers away. Nothing helped. The other girls stared with wide, round eyes as the planchet came alive under my fingers, which were still fixed to its surface, and it began to move. "Help!" the words spelled out under my hand. "Help me! Help me!" The planchet kept moving back and forth between the H-E-L-P continuously until Sarah cried out, "Who are you?" "Amber," the board spelled. "My name is Amber. I'm 8 years old." "What's wrong?" Mary asked. Her face was so white all the freckles stood out like darkened age spots. "Walter. Danger. Help. Scared." The words spelled out as fast as my hand could move. "Call 911, Mary cried suddenly. "Quick! Amber's in danger!" By this time Sarah was gasping into the phone. Then she hung up the phone. "They wouldn't listen to me," she told us, almost in tears. At that same instant, my hand was suddenly free from the planchet. "She's gone," I gasped. "See if you can contact her again," Mary said urgently. "We need to know if she's okay." I picked up the plastic planchet again. "Amber, are you there?" I asked softly, afraid of what might happen. After a long pause, it moved slowly across the board and spelled out the words, "Too late." And then, after another long pause, "Walter, flood, drowned, Mobile, Alabama." The planchet stopped. I knew that Amber was gone. None of us got much sleep that night. In the morning, we rushed through breakfast and then looked up the Alabama news on the internet. None of us were surprised to read that there had been flash floods the night before. I read the names of those who had died in the flood. One of the victims was an 8-year-old girl named Amber.
Axe Murder Hollow, a Pennsylvania ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Susan and Ned were driving through a wooded, empty section of highway. Lightning flashed, thunder roared, the sky went dark in the torrential downpour. "We'd better stop," said Susan. Ned nodded his head in agreement. He stepped on the brake, and suddenly the car started to slide on the slick pavement. They plunged off the road and slid to a halt at the bottom of an incline. Pale and shaking, Ned quickly turned to check if Susan was all right. When she nodded, Ned relaxed and looked through the rain-soaked windows. "I'm going to go see how bad it is," he told Susan, and he went out into the storm. She saw his blurry figure in the headlight, walking around the front of the car. A moment later, he jumped in beside her, soaking wet. "The car's not badly damaged, but we're wheel-deep in mud," he said. "I'm going to have to go for help." Susan swallowed nervously. There would be no quick rescue here. He told her to turn off the headlights and lock the doors until he returned. Axe Murder Hollow. Although Ned hadn't said the name aloud, they both knew what he had been thinking when he told her to lock the car. This was the place where a man had once taken an axe and hacked his wife to death in a jealous rage over an alleged affair. Supposedly, the axe-wielding spirit of the husband continued to still haunt this section of the road. Outside the car, Susan heard a shriek, a loud thump, and a strange gurgling noise. But she couldn't see anything in the darkness. Frightened, she shrank down into her seat. She sat in silence for a while, and then she noticed another sound. Bump, bump, bump. It was a soft sound, like something being blown by the wind. Suddenly, the car was illuminated by a bright light. An official-sounding voice told her to get out of the car. Ned must have found a police officer. Susan unlocked the door and stepped out of the car. As her eyes adjusted to the bright light, she saw it. Hanging by his feet from the tree next to the car was the dead body of Ned. His bloody throat had been cut so deeply that he was nearly decapitated. The wind swung his corpse back and forth so that it thumped against the tree. Bump. 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 Susan screamed and ran toward the voice and the light. As she drew close, she realized the light was not coming from a flashlight. Standing there was the glowing figure of a man with a smile on his face, and a large, solid, and definitely real axe in his hands. She backed away from the glowing figure until she bumped into the car. "Playing around when my back was turned," the ghost whispered, stroking the sharp blade of the axe with his fingers. "You've been very naughty." The last thing she saw was the glint of the axe blade and the eerie incandescent light.
Boo Hag, retold by S.E. Schlosser, from Spooky, North Carolina. You know how they say some folks are lucky at cards and some are lucky at love? Well, that fit Bobby Hansen to a T. He was the best poker player in the county, but somehow he couldn't find himself a bride. Oh, he proposed to several girls and even got accepted by a few, but they always got cold feet a day or two before the wedding, and it was bye-bye, Bobby. After the third time, Bobby was mighty discouraged, and his pa felt real sore for him. They worked together in the family grocery store, and Bobby would sometimes sit on top of the pickle barrel and tell his pa his woes. And his pa told him to hang in there because a nice lady was on her way. Neither of them believed it, but it made both of them feel better to hear it said. Well, the day after their latest talk, the old woman who pulled her barge through the swamp to deliver milk and eggs to the grocery store had a long talk with Bobby's pa. Seems she had this daughter who was hankering after a husband with a good steady job, and the old woman thought Bobby would do the job nicely. She suggested they introduce the pair at the next dance, and Bobby's pa agreed. The night of the dance, Bobby's pa insisted that his son dress in his best. Bobby was dragging his feet a little, remembering all those women who played him false and not wanting to go, but his pa dragged him out anyway. Well, the moment Bobby clapped eyes on the dark-eyed, red-lipped girl from the swamp, he was head over heels in love. Her eyes sparkled like the sunlight on the bay. Her skin was as creamy as new milk. Her voice was low and sweet. The pair cuddled and cooed and waltzed the whole night long. And come sunrise, Bobby was all for bringing his new love before the visiting priest who delivered his sermons in the grocery store, since there weren't no church in that vicinity, and getting married right away. Well, the girl was willing to get married, but not by a priest. "Let's just go to Beaumont and have the judge marry us," she said to Bobby. And he was so smitten he agreed, though it would have been quicker and easier just to walk a mile down the road to see the priest. By the next evening they were wed, and Bobby brought his pretty bride to the nice little cottage he rented just down the road from the family grocery. It had a nice front porch with a swing, a big bedroom on the second floor, and a big attic with a window that could be made up into a second guest room should his new mother-in-law care to visit from her home in the swamp. After fixing him a nice dinner, Bobby's new bride sat a while in the rocking chair near their bed while Bobby yawned and watched her fondly. She cuddled under the blanket and knitted and hummed, and Bobby's eyes grew heavy. He didn't wake up until early morning, when his new bride crept into bed all hot and sweaty and fell asleep at once. When he asked her where she'd been, she wouldn't answer him. Bobby was mighty sore that his bride had snuck out on him on their wedding night, but when she got snappish and her eyes blazed like they did when he questioned her, he grew frightened and backed down. Life took on an odd pattern for Bobby. During the day, everything was perfect. His wife was sweet and pretty and loving. She kept the house sparkling clean and cooked him wonderful meals, but each night she refused to come to bed after supper. Like their wedding night, she sat up singing and rocking and knitting until he was asleep and did not come to bed till just afore dawn. She was always sweaty and cranky when she came to bed and went to sleep before Bobby could question her. Bobby was very confused and upset by this behavior and finally confided in his pa one morning after opening up the grocery store. Bobby's pa was awful worried. The visiting priest had gone on to his next parish, and there was no one they could consult but the local conjure woman, so he sent Bobby to her with a couple of chickens as a gift. The conjure woman knew all about hoodoo magic and was an excellent herbalist. Local folks went to her when they were sick on account of the doctor lived nigh on 20 miles away. When she heard Bobby's story, she told him to pretend to go to sleep that night and watch what his new bride did. Then he was to come back and tell her everything. Bobby agreed. The next evening he pretended to fall asleep while his bride rocked and sang in her chair. Then he followed her up to the attic and watched through the crack in the open door as she sat down at the spinning wheel and spun off her skin, leaving only pulsing red muscles and blue veins. She was a terrifying sight, and she sprang through the window and flew away into the night. Bobby ran out to the privy and was sick after he saw her. Who? What was this monster he'd married? He was still trembling and in shock when his bride, looking like a normal person again, crept into bed at dawn, and he had trouble behaving normally at breakfast. As soon as he could get away, Bobby ran to the home of the conjure woman and told her about the spinning wheel and the terrible skinless creature who flew away from his attic. "A boo hag," the conjure woman said at once. "You married a boo hag." "What's a boo hag?" asked Bobby. "A boo hag is a witch and a shapeshifter," said the conjure woman. "She lures men into her trap and then delivers them to her boo daddy, who eats their flesh and gnaws their bones. And that's what she'll do to you if you don't get rid of her first." The conjure woman told Bobby to get himself some blue paint, As soon as the boo hag left the house that night, he was to spread blue paint on every window frame and every door frame and make sure it was 2 coats thick. A boo hag couldn't fly through a window or a door that was painted blue, and if she didn't get back into her skin before dawn, she would be trapped without it and be revealed for the monster she was. So he was to leave one tiny window unpainted and keep it open a sliver so the boo hag could squeeze through. Then he was to fill up her skin with salt and pepper, which would burn her up from the inside out, and Bobby promised to do exactly as the conjure woman said. That night Bobby lingered over his dinner, looking with sad eyes at the pretty woman sitting opposite him. He knew she was really a monster inside, but it was so nice to have a little wife in his home. He hated like anything to see her go, but he didn't want to get eaten up by a boo daddy, and that was his fate if she stayed. So he went up to their bedroom and pretended to fall asleep while she rocked and sang and knitted. Then he followed her quietly upstairs and put salt and pepper into her skin after her ugly red-muscled blue-veined figure had flown out of the window to her boo daddy. He spent the rest of the night painting over every door and window frame with blue paint, leaving only one small unpainted window open in the cellar. He nailed it up so that it would be open no further than a crack, just as the conjure woman instructed him. Then he hid himself behind a large chest of drawers up in the attic to wait for the boo hag. Just before dawn, the boo hag came flying up to the attic window. As soon as she touched the blue frame, she gave a shriek of pain and rage. Bobby listened as she flew around the house, testing each window and door and howling like a banshee when it burned her skinless hands. Then she found the little window in the cellar, and he heard the thump as she landed beside it, followed by a painful whimpering sound as she squeezed and squeezed herself through the narrow opening, her skinless red muscles and blue veins tearing painfully against the rough wood. The boo hag ran up 3 flights of stairs into the attic and squeezed into her skin as fast as she could. She just barely got it on when the first light of dawn shone over the horizon, and that was when the salt and pepper did their work, burning the boo hag's body from the inside out. With a scream of agony, she flung herself out the attic window. The glass shattered everywhere as she tried to fly away, tearing at the skin to get it off. But it was too late. She exploded into tiny pieces right over the swamp, and the alligators had them a mighty feast of cooked boo hag for breakfast that morning. So Bobby was once again without a wife. But bachelorhood looked much better to him after that, so he never went looking for a wife again. Of course, after he made a pile of money and oil, the girl started chasing him, but that's another story.
Birth of the Jersey Devil, a New Jersey legend, retold by S.E. Schlosser. A storm was raging that night in 1735 when Mother Leeds was brought into bed in childbirth. The room was full of women folk gathered to help her, more out of curiosity than goodwill. They had all heard the rumors that Mother Leeds was involved in witchcraft and had sworn she would give birth to a devil. Tension mounted when at last the baby arrived. It was a relief, and to some a disappointment, when the baby was born completely normal. But a few moments later, before their terrified eyes, the child began to change. The room erupted with screams as the child grew at an enormous rate, becoming taller than a man and changing into a beast which resembled a dragon, with a head like a horse, a snake-like body, and bat's wings. As soon as it was full grown, the monster began beating all the women, including his mother, with its thick forked tail. With a hoarse cry, it flew through the chimney and vanished into the storm. The monster of Leeds, or the Jersey Devil, as he was later called, still haunts the pines of New Jersey, wreaking havoc upon farmers' crops and livestock, poisoning pools and creeks, and appearing on the New Jersey shore just before a shipwreck.
Fifty-cent piece, a New York ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. There is a story told in Troy and Albany about a couple returning home from a trip to New England. They were driving home in a carriage, and were somewhere near Spiegeltown when the light failed, and they knew they would have to seek shelter for the night. The husband spied a light through the trees and turned their horse into a small lane leading up a hill. A pleasant little house stood at the crest, and an old man and his wife met the couple at the door. They were in night clothes and were obviously about to turn in, but they welcomed the travelers and offered them a room. The old woman bustled about making tea and offering freshly baked cakes. Then the travelers were shown to their room. The husband wanted to pay the old couple for their lodgings, but the lady shook her head and the old man refused any payment for such a small service to their fellow New Yorkers. The travelers awoke early and tiptoed out of the house, leaving a shiny 50-cent coin in the center of the kitchen table, where the old couple could not miss it. The husband hitched up the horse, and they went a few miles before they broke their fast at a little restaurant in Spiegeltown. The husband mentioned the nice old couple to the owner of the restaurant, and the man turned pale. "Where did you say that house was?" he asked. The husband described the location in detail. "Oh, you must be mistaken," said the restaurant owner. "That house was destroyed 3 years ago by a fire that killed the Brown family." "I don't believe it," the husband said flatly. "Mr. and Mrs. Brown were alive and well last night." After debating for a few more minutes, the couple and the restaurant owner drove the carriage back out of town towards the old Brown place. They turned into the lane, which was overgrown with weeds, and climbed the hill to the crest. There, they found a burned-out shell of a house that had obviously not sheltered anyone for a long time. "I must have missed the track," said the husband. And then his wife gave a terrified scream and fainted into his arms. As he caught her, the husband looked into the ruin and saw a burnt table with a shiny 50-cent piece lying in the center.
Session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleradingservice.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.